From Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by a panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Michael Bauer, Sidney Blumenthal, Brian Lambrecht, Michael Lotus, Charles Lipson, and Robert Pape. Our program tonight coming to you from the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Nice to have you with us on the 4th of July weekend. This is a recorded show, so no phone calls this evening. However, there are just 13 days to go before the Republican convention in Cleveland and 127 days to go before Election Day. And we have lots to talk about a little bit later on in the program. Robert Pate will be here. He is one of the world's foremost authorities in terrorism. And we will talk about what happened in Istanbul and also the war against terror, and that will be one of the things we will discuss as the program unfolds. And later on, for those listening to the broadcast on radio, Sidney Blumenthal, former close advisor to Bill and Hillary Clinton, author of a new book about Abraham Lincoln, will join us late in tonight's broadcast. But I want to begin, since we mentioned Bill Clinton already, let's talk about Bill Clinton has thrust himself back into the news again because of an impromptu or allegedly impromptu meeting at the Phoenix airport with the Attorney General Loretta Lynch, and it has caused some Republicans to cry foul. Even some Democrats are raising their eyebrows, and we're going to be discussing that in segment number one. Michael Bauer, you're the closest thing to a card-carrying Democrat here this evening. What is your reaction to what Bill Clinton did and what Loretta Lynch did?
Well, first, okay, let me say about what Bill Clinton did. And I should preface my comments by saying I'm voting for Hillary Clinton this November.
Okay.
All right? One of the difficulties Hillary Clinton has in her campaign, as she had in 2008, is Bill Clinton. You know, and Bill Clinton never seems to lose an opportunity to be able to hurt his wife's campaign. And he showed exceptionally poor judgment and approaching the Attorney General, and he gives off a perspective that the Clintons once again believe normal rules don't apply to them.
Michael Lotus also joins us. You are a Donald Trump supporter. Your reaction to the incident at the airport?
I'm kind of astonished. As an attorney, you frequently are in situations where someone who probably shouldn't speak to you, they might be an employee of a represented party or something like that, and you just simply say, I can't speak to you. Now, it's funny. I went online to see if I could find any specific rule that the Department of Justice may have that forbids this contact. The prudent thing for her to do would have said, Mr. President, I simply can't speak to you. Your wife, we all know, is subject to an investigation right now. She should have just distanced herself.
Charles Upson from the University of Chicago. Nice to have you with us, Charles.
Thank you.
Your
Bruce.
Reaction to this tete-a-tete on the tarmac?
Well, for Loretta Lynch, at least, it was a horrible mistake. And I want to agree with both Michaels. But I want to particularly reinforce Michael Lotus's point about why Loretta Lynch shouldn't have spoken. It's not just that Hillary Clinton is being investigated. There's a huge white-collar crime investigation going on at the FBI and DOJ. Now, why is there a white-collar criminal investigation going on? That has to do with whether anything that was done at the State Department was part of a pay-for-play operation
with the foundation,
with the foundation. Who's the head of the foundation?
Bill Clinton.
So there's just absolutely no excuse for this.
Brian Lambrecht is our libertarian. Brian, what's your response to what happened?
My response is that this is America and the Clintons are political royalty. It's almost an aristocracy with them. They feel that they're above rules, and therefore what Bill Clinton did, it's not much surprising. It's kind of part of his character. We almost expect it. Mm-hmm. But Loretta Lynch, that's different. She should know better. And generally, she makes better decisions than that. Of course, we talked last time about her trying to censor transcripts on the latest incident. But for Bill Clinton, it's kind of what we expect.
We
what else did we talk about?
Bruce, we did not know about this until a local reporter asked the question. They did not disclose it. We only learned about it 2 days later. And then when Loretta Lynch came out, she said, I spoke primarily. I mean, this was just a storm of problems from the get-go here.
You said, Michael, in response to the first question, you implied that Bill Clinton has screwed this campaign up on several occasions in the past.
Well, he screwed it up in 2008.
Yes, big time.
Does
he want her to win? What do you think?
Know, that's a fascinating question.
Thank you. That's why I get paid the big bucks.
I think a lot of us wondered about that in 2008, whether there's some sort of, you know, now we're psychoanalyzing Bill Clinton, and I would be the last one to want to do that. But whether he has some sort of hidden perspective that he's not even totally cognizant of, that he wants to undermine his wife's
Anybody
campaign.
Anybody want to weigh in on that? I mean, it's pretty far off. Anybody want to weigh in on that?
I do. I think that there are also questions about the White House. I think what they'd really like is to figure out a way to get Joe Biden in there. But I don't think now that Bernie Sanders has remained in, I think they fear they'd blow up the party if
she
they did
has
it.
Said, she has now said that she will follow the dictates of whatever the FBI recommends. She has said that she's going to follow through on that. So she's out there now. Now, are people going to believe that? Let me ask the Trump folks that have a lot of conspiracy theorists involved in your campaign or supporters of your team. Will they believe that? Because on one hand, James Comey has been held up as this guy that is impeachable. You can't get to him. If he comes back and says we're not going to prosecute, mm-hmm. and she agrees with that. What are the conspiracy theorists are going to say?
If he came back and said we're not going to prosecute, everyone who believes in conspiracies would have said the fix is in. So at this point, enough people know enough of the facts and can read the statute and say she should be in real serious trouble. I'm struck by the fact that Loretta Lynch said she's going to do what the report says. She hasn't even read it yet. I mean, she could have any number of reasonable objections to it. It was a very strange
but
thing
she,
for her to
but,
say.
But in essence, what she's saying is, as I understand Eric Holder did, when there's been a political issue, is that he would take the recommendation of the professional politicians.
The professional prosecutors.
Can I ask you a question, Michael, as a lawyer? If a mid-level person at the DOJ had met with Bill Clinton informally, what would happen to that person?
Now, I don't work at the DOJ, and I tried to look into their internal rules today and see if I could discern a specific violation. I have to think that person would at least get talked to with the door closed. It certainly looks bad. It's inappropriate. And
speaking about talking with the door closed, what blame do we put on the security forces? Now, clearly, none. But she is traveling with security. Shouldn't her security people have known that it would be inappropriate? Just because he's
no.
the former president
Their
of the United States.
Their job is to provide security, not to provide political advice.
Cover.
That's right.
Absolutely. But I think we need to understand something with the situation with Bill Clinton. You know, first of all, he's created an issue that has now dominated the news cycle for two straight days.
Yes.
And yesterday and today, and forced Loretta Lynch to do an embarrassing
mea culpa
this morning at Aspen. In addition, one of Hillary's great weaknesses is the public views her as much less trustworthy and honest than Donald Trump. You know, NBC's latest poll has Donald Trump leading significantly on trustworthy and honest. This just adds to the issue as to whether the Clintons are trustworthy and honest.
There's lots more to discuss, and we will do that when we roll on. I'm Bruce Dumont on the 4th of July edition of Beyond the Beltway, from coast to coast and border to border and around the world on the World Wide Web.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
Thank you all very much, Admiral Kelly, Captain Card, officers and sailors of the USS Abraham Lincoln, my fellow Americans. Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night on Antenna TV.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
Brian Lambrick, let me ask you. You are a supporter of Gary Johnson. You're a libertarian. Is there a libertarian position on this discussion? I mean, what should Gary Johnson be saying? Because if he's saying anything on this issue, I'm not hearing it.
I'm not hearing anything specific on it. I think he's trying to stay out of it. And, of course, the guy's campaigning and getting a lot more media attention than any libertarian presidential candidate's ever gotten. So I don't know if he wants to jump into the thick of this. And as we said before, conspiracy theory, I think you're going to have to lob off the word theory at a certain point. The Clintons have revolutionized the idea of bringing in cash and being able to sell off favors. They've done it a whole new way that makes it almost impossible to connect anything. Any normal American, any person in this room can look at what's going on and connect those dots and say, there it is, there's a perfect image. But if you can't nail something down, a uranium deal with Russia or an oil deal with Saudi Arabia and favors that are coming in the State Department through Bill Clinton giving speeches, how can you nail something down like that? That makes it really tough.
Well, I don't understand. Charles. Why honesty and rule of law are not centerpieces of the libertarian campaign.
Honesty and rule of law, in what way?
Well, it seems to me that it's a problem in both parties that honesty and rule of law, not just the limited government and those issues, but that the core American value that everybody, including senior government officials, have to obey the rule of law, and that honest service from government officials is what we expect, ought to be a core value in both parties. But when it's not, I don't see why the libertarians don't jump in on it.
We're very big on transparency and having everything open and available for people to jump on and discuss. That's part of the idea of honesty. I mean, you know, honesty is ridiculously subjective. Transparency shouldn't be.
Well, it's not a matter of subjective honesty. One of the key ideas of the rule of law is that every single person in the society is subject to the same rules. And if you're wealthy and powerful, okay, you can afford good counsel, but it's the same rules for everybody. And we've gotten so cynical at this point, we kind of laugh this off. It's
we have
really
said-
bad.
Over the last year and a half, when it looked like obviously Hillary Clinton was going to be the nominee, one issue that I've talked about in this program, and we've got callers that have called in as well, is that if Hillary Clinton gets elected, I guess a pool will immediately start in the national news media. When is Bill Clinton going to do something or say something that will embarrass the nation, as he did when he was president on several occasions? And we now see an example with what happened in
right.
Phoenix.
Right.
This is the first of many missteps that are going to embarrass his wife, whether she's the candidate or she's the president of the United States.
You know, I've always thought of Bill Clinton as kind of like the bad boy type from high school. You know, the guy who always tried to see how far he could get with doing stuff and the guy who actually got away with a lot of this stuff and was proud of himself, and that only encouraged him to keep trying and keep going further and further. And that, unfortunately, is a bad attribute in politics.
Do you think that the climate in the country has changed significantly in the last 15 years so that the charges of rape and some of the sexual indiscretions that led to his impeachment, which obviously he was acquitted by the U.S. Senate, but have times changed that people today would look at that same evidence and come up differently?
Absolutely.
Tell us why. Tell us what you think is happening.
If you look at the attitude towards, say, a rape accusation that was made against Bill Clinton many years ago versus today. Hillary Clinton herself said a woman who makes a rape accusation is entitled to be believed. Well, her husband's been accused of all kinds of bad behavior, and there's reason to believe a lot of it's the case. Now, agreed, he's got a kind of a bad boy thing about him, and everyone here would probably rather have a drink with him than his wife, and he'd be an interesting guy. But he has hurt some people, and he's done some bad things.
But millennials, supposedly millennials, are overwhelmingly supportive of Hillary Clinton, according to the polls. So, I mean, that's the demographic
group.
Wait,
when you say that, supportive of Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump or supportive of Hillary Clinton versus Bernie Sanders?
No, over Donald Trump, not Bernie Sanders.
Okay, because I would suggest that millennials, you know, who are heavily supportive of Bernie Sanders are still trying to figure out where they're going this November.
Do you think, Charles, I'm going to ask you, do you think that Hillary Clinton will be indicted, and if so, give us the scenario of what you think happens.
I have no idea. I think she should be.
Don't keep that from giving you an answer. Don't let that stop you from giving an answer.
But I can tell you that I think that the evidence that's already in the public record is that she should be indicted. And the reason for that is that whatever her intention is not part of the Espionage Act. She knowingly stored all of this material on an unsecured private server. She knowingly, and all of her aides knowingly, avoided FOIA requests. That's one of the reasons they set it up. A third thing is that I'm almost certain that the information that she calls private, of which there's more than 30,000 emails, involve a lot of things involving public business, including the foundation and her public record, including the breakfasts and so forth that she had, has been scrubbed of those meetings. So I don't see any reason why she shouldn't be indicted.
Michael.
I can't make a prediction. My cynical mind says they'll somehow find a way to halt it from happening. If you the public record, what we can see, she appears to have violated the statute. Intent is not an element, as Charles said, and I don't see how, if they just do things by the book, she doesn't get indicted.
Does if that happens, and let's say Joe Biden, who's the most obvious person, does it make it more difficult for Donald Trump to make it to the White House if Joe Biden is the opponent?
Hillary's your dream candidate to run against because of all the weaknesses she has. So, sure, I think almost.
How does it affect the Gary Johnson equation, Brian? I mean, it seems to me that at least in the last couple of weeks, the fact that the negatives of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are so large that if someone came along who was likable, like likable Joe, it would decrease the likelihood of people voting for Gary Johnson.
Gary Johnson has been pulling 2 to 3 times as many voters away from Hillary Clinton as Trump, and people weren't expecting that. Usually we're always blamed for being a spoiler with Republicans, but it's right. Been Democrats a lot lately. And at the same time, you've got Gary Johnson and his running mate, William Weld, Gary from, you know, former Republican governor from a blue state, New Mexico, and William Weld, Republican governor from the blue state of Massachusetts, 2 terms each time. I think they have a really good chance to pull a lot of attention from that. But with regards to Hillary and whether or not her being indicted, all the scandals, and we could go through the alphabet soup of scandals that she's got, they're all connected together. And as more things come out, we start to find out about them. Her IT technician guy's name was, I had it here, Brian Pagliano. Yeah, he pleaded the fifth 125 times to avoid giving any kind of testimony. I mean, that says something, but again, what kind of evidence are you getting out of that?
Why, amongst your friends, Michael, you hang around probably with more Democrats than anybody around this table on a regular basis. What are they saying about this? They may loathe Donald Trump. Many of them hate Donald Trump.
Right.
But is the enthusiasm level for Hillary Clinton strong or not?
Well, among what I'm going to call the party faithful, I think there's deep enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton. Among a lot of women, there's enthusiasm about finally having the possibility of finally having a woman president. I think in the general Democratic base, as you can see by the polling, there's a strong lack of enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton. And the race between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, with all forgiveness to Gary Johnson right now, is a race between the lesser of two evils, not a race of who is the more appealing candidate.
Do you agree that the issues, the trust issues that you alluded to earlier, are those, in your mind, are those legitimate issues?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the private server, I think Charles said this, and the private server clearly was set up to try to avoid FOIA requests. Now, I'm not sure not responding to FOIA requests is a criminal action. You know, and by the way, if we're going to start prosecuting elected officials or appointed officials in government for trying to avoid FOIA requests.
But when you say no, when somebody petitions you and you say you have nothing and you know that you have it.
Well, I think I would argue that when you get petitioned with a FOIA request and you delay it for a year or 2 years, it's the same thing as saying that you have nothing. It's not compliance with the statute. And the question becomes, is that a criminal act?
Well, Michael, I want
to
ask you.
But it is a trustworthy issue. Absolutely.
Yeah. An issue about, and this gets into the trustworthy issue, and it gets into, I think, which is even a stronger issue, and that is what Bernie Sanders has talked about and Donald Trump has alluded to in the last couple of days, and that is the judgment. look at Hillary Clinton's judgment. Does she get an A or a D on judgment? And I want that brings up the discussion of Benghazi. Now, the whole world has heard about Benghazi for several years now. Mm-hmm. In your view, does Benghazi represent an issue that the average person understands and they are going to hold Hillary Clinton accountable for the death of four Americans?
It depends if it's presented to them in a clear and simple way.
Has it been presented that way thus far?
I'm not sure it has. I think.
Do you think it has, Brian?
No, and the same thing with the emails, with the server scandal, the same thing with Benghazi, same thing with the Clinton Foundation, with, you know, the Clinton cash. I don't think they've been made very clear for
the people. Charles, we've talked. You've been on the show many times when we brought up that issue. Is that issue any clearer in the minds of the non-political voter whose vote is going to count just as much as anyone at this table?
Benghazi is not clear. I do think that the emails and the servers and the general corruption issues are fairly clear, and I think that's now baked into the cake.
And I think,
Michael,
and I agree, I don't think Benghazi is really the issue. I think Benghazi is an issue that's been overblown. If you want to look at judgment issues, judgment issue number one, the Hillary Clinton is Secretary of State and her husband is off doing speeches and getting paid large sums, or the foundation is collecting large sums. That's inappropriate. He should have never done any of that.
We got to pause. Thanks for joining us tonight on the 4th of July edition of Beyond the Beltway. When we come back, we're going to talk with Robert Pape from the University of Chicago, one of the world's foremost authorities on terrorism, and we're going to talk about what happened in Istanbul.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels.
Join me for a new season of Wild Travels, Sundays at 11 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
The Museum of Broadcast Communications is Chicago's perfect place for senior citizens. Enjoy a stroll down memory lane. Reminisce as museum artifacts, photos, and classic TV shows trigger recollections from your childhood. Enjoy the TLC you'll receive from our expert tour guides. Discounts for groups of 20 or more. Schedule yours right now at museum.tv or call 312-245-8200. Plan your fun trip now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you for joining us for this recorded edition of our broadcast. One of the big stories last week was the terrorist attack at the airport in Istanbul. We are very pleased to have on the program this evening an old guest, a regular guest on this program for many, many years from the University of Chicago, Robert Pape, who is one of the world's foremost authorities in terrorism and tracking terrorism. He's written numerous books, including Cutting the Fuse, which is his most recent book. Professor, nice to have you with us. And I understand you're a very close colleague with one of our guest this evening, Charles Lipson, also from the UFC. But tell us, in your opinion, what is the most relevant thing the public should know about the terrorist attack at Istanbul's airport?
The most relevant thing is that this type of an attack is likely to continue, probably not for the rest of our lives, but we should be expecting this over the period of the next year and a half. It is the latest in a series of spectacular attacks again that ISIS has carried out, using suicide and other attackers to target members of the military coalition against it. Ankara, last October 10th, was the first of these spectacular attacks. On October 10th, two suicide bombers connected with ISIS killed over 100 people in Ankara. And I'm afraid what we've just witnessed is the continuation of attacks that we've seen in Ankara, downing of the Russian airliner, Paris, Belgium, Orlando, and now Istanbul. And what they all have in common is ISIS is targeting countries that are part of the Western coalition that is shrinking ISIS territory in Iraq and Syria.
When you were last on this program several months ago, you warned that this might happen because, as you described then, ISIS was losing on the battlefield. And in the last several months, certainly even in the last week, there's strong indication that they continue to lose ground on the battlefield. Do you still stand by that prediction? And although we may be cheering victories on the battlefield, in essence, we may be paying a bigger price in a wide variety of areas around the world.
We are seeing, unfortunately, this prediction come to be. What happened starting about 2 years ago is that ISIS grabbed a large amount of territory in Iraq and Syria and began to encroach on the oil regions in Iraq, in the north and in the south. That was something that we had to act to prevent ISIS from gaining a large amount of the world's oil. As we have acted to contract the space, ISIS is losing territory at a fantastic clip. It now controls less than half of the populated territory in Iraq that it controlled 2 years ago, and it is losing control of territory every month. As it's going down, it's lashing out like a cornered animal. Based on the trajectory of the campaign, it was likely to be another year and a half before we have effectively dismembered ISIS. And so when the next president comes to office, we're likely going to have a situation not of how to crush ISIS, but how to prevent ISIS from rising again.
Do we know, in the case of the Istanbul airport attack, do we know who really did it?
Well, we don't know. ISIS has not claimed the attack, and they don't claim every attack. But in this case, the attackers themselves are individuals whose nationalities are from old Soviet republics that ISIS has been targeting with their video campaigns. So, Bruce, I've been studying ISIS video propaganda videos with a rather large research team now for 8 months. ISIS's videos are not just generally large in number, they're targeted. And they have been targeting Kazakhstan. They have been targeting North Caucasus. They have been targeting specific parts of Russia and the republics of the former Soviet Union, which have large Muslim majorities, in order to recruit fighters to do their bidding. This has all the hallmarks of an attack that ISIS has not just generally inspired, but specifically inspired.
Bob, your colleague from the University of Chicago, Charles Upson, is around the roundtable in Chicago. He's got a comment directly for you.
Bob, in addition to these highly planned attacks, like the one in Paris, the several in Turkey and elsewhere, there have been lone wolf attacks, the one in California, the one in Orlando, before that in Boston. And what's the relationship between these highly coordinated attacks and these lone wolf attacks? How should we think about the two?
We should think that ISIS has created a new middle category. I'm calling it now command-inspired. Several years ago, we used to talk about lone wolf attacks, where an individual might have heard of ISIS and just generally did an attack, such as the Ottawa shooter several years ago who killed a couple of people. This is now different. In the last several years, ISIS has put together a series of interlocking webs of media, social media, where they are putting online the scripts in detail to produce, carry out attacks on office buildings, airports, not just in general, but going through all the detailed
steps. That has not been adequately reported, Bob. What you're saying is very important. It's typically reported as lone wolf rather than this inspired and
here's
the details on how to do it.
That's right. So after Orlando, I did a piece in the Boston Globe, Charles, just to try to get the message out that what ISIS has done is they are producing attacks the way a movie producer produces attacks. one, script, or hire people to write the detailed script. Number two, they produce videos to basically create casting calls to go get specific types of individuals to come and do the attacks. Number three, they generate publicity for the attackers in Dabiq and other online forums that are like their People's Magazine. So Mateen, who did the Orlando attack, just June 23rd, just a week ago, there's a four-page spread in Dabiq by ISIS celebrating as a celebrity, like Bruce Springsteen almost, Mateen as this glorious attacker for ISIS. This is a new thing, Charles. This is not the old distinction between command orchestrated and inspired. This is, I'm calling it command inspired, where they are basically putting together an interlocking set of pieces of social media, which is creating a whole new ability to carry out call them lone wolves if you want, but highly deadly attacks where dozens and dozens of people are being killed.
Professor,
very different than lone wolves.
Let me just interrupt. Brian Lambert, who's our libertarian around the table this evening, he's got a question or comment for you.
Yeah, hey, Robert. What I'm wondering about this is that Turkey is not exactly the pro-Western country that it used to be, especially in the last decade. And seeing what could have been ISIS in this seems a little bit weird. Seems like it's a different target. So I was curious as why they might make this a target. And also, another question for you is it possible that if this isn't ISIS and nobody can confirm that and they haven't leaped out to take credit like they usually do, could this be the PKK? Could this be the Kurds? And if it is the Kurdish terrorist group in Turkey, they get a lot of their weapons from the Peshmerga. How does the Peshmerga get their weapons? They're getting it from us. If it is the PKK, this could tie back to us and maybe there could be some blowback. What do you think about that?
The PKK has never had an attacker from anybody outside of Turkey. That is, none of the PKK attackers have ever come from Soviet republics or from, say, Indonesia or Bosnia or anywhere else. They are all of their attackers, which we track in detail at CPOS, the Chicago Project on Security and Terrorism, are essentially Kurds who are coming from Turkey. So the identity of the Istanbul attackers just simply doesn't fit the PKK. Moreover, the PKK has never carried out a multiple complex coordinated attack with multiple aim points the way that ISIS has over many, many different attacks. And so it's true, we can't say absolutely 100%, but the Turkish authorities, who often just try to blame the PKK, they too know this is really has all the hallmarks of ISIS. Now, why Turkey? It's because starting about a year and a half ago, Turkish government allowed bases and other areas for the United States to use for its
Robert.
Airport. They, too, have also carried out their own strikes here. But fundamentally, Turkey has been trying to play two sides of a street, and they have supported the United States as part of the Western military offensive against ISIS.
Robert, let me ask you a basic question for those listening. It's the 4th of July weekend. We're heading into, obviously, you know, prime vacation time for many people listening and watching to our broadcast this evening. Would you advise people to go on a vacation somewhere outside the United States?
I would go. I've just come back just a few weeks ago from Athens myself. Athens, which is in Greece, which is, you know, I just went through the Paris airport just 45 minutes after the plane that disappeared from the Paris airport. I think it's a complete mistake to think that you as an individual are likely to be targeted. I think that what we see, moreover, is what ISIS is doing is they are looking to target not every mom and pop, like soda can or hot dog stand. What they're they're looking to do is they are attacking places where they can predict at certain times in certain places there will be hundreds and hundreds of people. That's what you're seeing over and over and over again in the targets that ISIS is selecting.
We've got to pause right now, but we will be back with Robert Pape from the University of Chicago, as well as our in-studio guest this evening on Beyond the Beltway, 4th of July edition, wherever you're listening from coast to coast and border to border on beyondthebeltway.com. Nice to have you with us.
The beauty of Amlink's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlink's now at 888-880-TREE. Come on down to the Museum of Broadcast Communications and enjoy Watching TV in the 1990s, a new exhibition featuring pop culture memorabilia, trend-setting TV shows, music videos, and commercials. Remember Beanie Babies, Touchtone Phones, and the Macarena? Turn back the clock 20 years and bring your friends. Now showing at the NBC 360 North State Street in Chicago. That's 360 North State Street in downtown Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. Michael Bauer has a question for you, Professor Pape.
So I have read recently that ISIS, through social media, released the names of, I believe, 4,000 Americans and their personal information, encouraging their followers in the United States to go out and kill any members of the United States, any citizens of the United States that are on this list. Have you heard this, and is this true? And if so, what should the U.S. government be doing?
I don't know the number is exactly 4,000, but this is part of the script that ISIS has been. When I say they are producing attacks and writing the script for attackers, this isn't just general fly-by-night vague ideas. They are putting online detailed attack plans, identifying specific places, specific individuals, and they're doing it in a way that people can start to understand what it would mean to do the not just the attack on the day, but preparation starting several weeks before the attack, then the few days before the attack. So Mateen's wife took him to the club just a few days before the attack to do reconnaissance to find out when do the security people take their breaks, when he can easily get through.
And she has not been charged.
Pardon me?
And she has not been charged.
That is an issue. I definitely understand, Charles, and you are right to bring that up. What I'm saying is that this is not coming from a team. This is coming from ISIS's scripts. And so we need to take seriously that ISIS here has learned this is not the old Al-Qaeda. They are using a whole variety of social media and online techniques in much more aggressive ways. And they are using these Western techniques that we have produced, by the way, for generally good purposes. They are using these very same techniques now far more seriously to kill us. They're not rejecting Western ideas. They're exploiting them for their own evil purposes.
One last question from Michael Lotus. Go ahead.
Professor Pape, let's assume that the allies fighting against ISIS overrun their territory. What is the likelihood and how effective will they be if they just take this thing completely virtual? They just live online and do the same scripting and get better at it and provoke these attacks without having a tangible
So by losing the territory, they will be substantially reduced. So the Hollywood of ISIS is in Mosul. We know because we can track the videos that are coming out of the different parts of ISIS, and we can see who's producing what. It doesn't mean, however, that simply military victory means the end of ISIS. we've already had a situation where we had Al-Qaeda in Iraq that was spawned from our invasion of Iraq. That's what produced it. Then we diminished Al-Qaeda in Iraq after many years, and then it rose like a phoenix, mainly because we lacked political solutions to the Sunni problems in Iraq.
Or will they just move to Libya or some other safe space, Bob, to produce all this?
The ungoverned space in general is a problem, but it's specifically a problem in Iraq and Syria because we created and broke a space where there are tens of millions of Sunnis that are ripe for ISIS. And this is something that we are, I think we militarily, we can do something about. We can diminish the threat rather greatly in the next year. I think, however, that what the next president has to do is prevent the rise of ISIS or another like ISIS group rising from a phoenix in 4 or 5 years. And this is about political solutions to deal with ungoverned space, much of which we have broken.
Last question. You have communicated in the last 20 minutes more in-depth analysis than I've heard or seen on television and radio in the last 3 years on this subject. What grade do you give the American media in properly informing the public about what you have shared with us tonight?
A C minus. They are doing better than a D or an F. But they are not doing the average that they used to do in the 80s and 90s, Bruce. So you and I are old enough now to remember the days when profit didn't drive the news cycle, when there were programs like yours that actually could cover things in depth. Those are just disappearing more and more, and they're disappearing because of the profits that have now driven our news as well as all the other parts of television. And this is very sad because it is making it very difficult. Back in when the Russian airliner went down, I sent some of our national news agencies the actual video from ISIS, not just the actual ISIS video that they downed the plane. And it took them 5 days to report the story. They did eventually, but this is a world that has now changed where the media, I'm afraid, is simply not what it used to be 20 years ago.
Robert Papalis, and I thank you very much for being with us. The title of your book is Cutting the Fuse. That's the most recent one. And again, you work at the University of Chicago. You're involved in a major project down there that is tracking all terrorist attacks all over the United States, especially related to suicide bombing. And again, when I introduced you as one of the foremost authorities in the world in terrorism, that was not just off some book jacket. We're delighted that you're doing this significant research at the University of Chicago. We thank you very much for being with us on this 4th of July as we're celebrating independence and Independence Day, and yet we understand that that independence comes with a price that unfortunately is affecting the way we live our lives. Charles?
You know, what you said in congratulating Bob, which I want to share in, I'm very fortunate to have him as a colleague, enjoy talking with him all the time about these issues, reminded me of what Ben Rhodes said when he spun the Iran deal. Whether you like that deal or don't like that deal, what he said was, I'm talking to 27-year-olds who've only reported on political campaigns. They don't know anything about these issues. They can't report them. I don't know that it's the profit motive. It doesn't cost any more to have a real expert like Bob on than to have some goofball on.
Might be cheaper.
Screaming at each other.
Exactly. But we have, you say he's a moron, you say he's a Nobel Prize winner. We'll be back right after this. Yeah. You know, I hate that kind of stuff. That's why I like being on with you, Bruce.
Thank you very much. We do have to pause. Again, no phone calls this evening because we are recorded. But again, as Charles just alluded, I mean, that's one of the reasons why we are here. And I think having listened to Professor Pape for the last 20 minutes, as well as our studio guests here in Chicago, not all the wisdom in this country resides on the banks of the Potomac River. Back shortly from Chicago.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida, so why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes, revel in a glorious island sunset, shop the boutiques of a seaside village, ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
The beauty of Amling's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlings now at 888-880-TREE.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels.
Join me for a new season of Wild Travels, Saturdays at 4:30 and Sundays at 11 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. I never told anybody to lie, not a single time, never. These allegations are false, and I need to go back to work for the American people. Thank you.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
Beyond the Beltway continues on 4th of July weekend, and we've gone an hour into this broadcast, and we haven't talked about Donald Trump. That's got to be a record in the last 18 months, or at least a year. Michael Lotus, are you confident that the Stop Trump movement is running into trouble, or are they getting more gas?
Well, I resolved last January to make no predictions about Donald Trump since everybody's been wrong, including me. But what I do think is, and this is kind of a shock, after him having a terrible month or so, you had a Quinnipiac poll come out where he was up 2 points. Most normal people would have disintegrated by now. I think the only hope for the Never Trump folks is if he is so obviously a sinking ship that people who are on the fence are going to want an alternative. As long as he looks plausible and viable, it's going to be very tough for people to
turn against.
Is
he a sinking ship, Charles Lipson?
He seems to be putting holes in his ship below the waterline, and yet the ship constantly stays up. I'll say this about Trump.
Does he want to be president?
Oh, absolutely. He wants to be president, and he wants to be an extremely strong and consequential president. I'll say this about Never Trump. Never Trump for a long time meant nominate somebody else at the Republican convention. That could not really have happened without blowing up the party, and even then could have only happened if he were down 15 points in the national polls. He's not going to be down
Rasmussen
that many.
Rasmussen has him ahead at the moment in the national polls.
I don't know whether he's ahead or behind. I think that the whole campaign is going to be negative. The main thing for Donald Trump is he's not Hillary Clinton. The main thing for Hillary Clinton is she's not Donald Trump, and that's the room for Gary Johnson.
But that's what I want to get back to what you think. You're not here speaking for the campaign.
No.
But in your mind, what is the strategy? What is a win for Gary Johnson this year?
Well, the win for Gary Johnson, first of all, for libertarians in general, is just to continue watching what's going to happen at these conventions between Donald Trump and then, of course, the Bernie supporters and if they're going to latch on to Hillary. This is fun for us to watch this whole kind of thing just explode and crumble around. It's beautiful in a way for people that are just angry at the system. They don't have to be anarcho-capitalists. They don't have to be people completely angry at the system, but you're mad. That's why Trump does so well. Trump doesn't say anything heroically intelligent or brilliant. He goes out there and says, this is pretty terrible, and he's getting a lot of support from people. Bernie Sanders said the exact same thing, even though they have different solutions for the same problems, but they go at it. Hillary, I don't see her offering much of anything, so it's hard to pinpoint her on that.
But is Gary Johnson and William Weld, do they have the knowledge of what it needs, what needs to be said to get more votes? Because, again, right now they're the alternative to two parties or two candidates that a lot of people don't like or don't trust. But, again, I don't hear him sort of speaking the message of anger, certainly, that Donald Trump and even Bernie Sanders have been speaking.
Gary Johnson, from what I've been able to see, he's not really running against Trump or against Hillary. He's running for... this is beautifully poetic, running for the American people, running as another option, and not even a third option, a second option. When you look at the two people and see just how closely they are on so many issues, whether personally or the way they are on the actual politics, they're very similar. And having somebody who's actually got executive experience and has a record that says, hey, I don't see
how he wins a single state.
It's possible. It's possible to win a few of them. And again, everyone knows the idea where if you can get a couple of those from certain states, if the math works out between Hillary and Trump, then it ends up going to the House.
Well,
it could happen.
I think
Michael Bauer. The
bigger issue and the more immediate issue for Gary Johnson and Bill Weld is, can they get enough in the polls that they actually get into the debates?
That's the big
issue. If they get into debates, they get a certain amount of exposure.
Mm-hmm. And credibility.
And credibility. But right now, they're far away from their goal.
He's got a lawsuit. I think it's Our America Initiative that's in order to get them or at least bring the standard down. I think it's 15%.
15% is the threshold.
And they've been between 9% and 16%. It's not bad.
It should be. As I've said last week on this program, Gary Johnson should definitely be in the debate. And again, if you are on enough ballots to get you to 270 votes, in my view, you should be in those debates.
Bruce, I thought that one of the most disturbing stories that I've heard in the past month was that the three Democratic FCC commissioners voted to sanction Fox News for holding an undercard debate with the other Republicans who didn't make the main debate stage. They call that an in-kind contribution to the Republican Party. The fact that three Democrats on the FCC.
FEC.
Was it the FEC? I thought it was the committee in charge of communications. That what they're saying is that holding open debates is a violation of their rules, was one of the most troubling signs of a government that is completely out of control and a government that wants to suppress speech.
Well, again, that's why I think that, again, a lot of pressure should be put on the presidential commission. That, again, with the caveat that I suggested, they've got to be on enough states to win, but they should be on that debate stage. Now, my question to you is, Charles, is do you believe that the anti-Trump animus in the media, as well, obviously, you expect it from the Democratic Party. You expect it, you know, they all have their talking points, and they go out and they read the talking points. Michael, you do not, which I appreciate. One of the reasons why I like to have you as a guest, we don't quite know where you're coming in response to the questions. But my question is... has there been too much overkill? Is it so obvious that the national media is out to literally destroy Donald Trump, frequently by just playing the tape of what he just said? I will acknowledge that. But, I mean, I can't think of any candidate, including Barry Goldwater, who has been attacked the way that Donald Trump has been attacked thus far. We got a long way to go.
It'll hurt him a lot. And the fact that they're not playing up a lot of Hillary's problems, they've never put the number of people, look at the number of people that the Times and the Post put on Donald Trump compared to open source scandals running out of the Clinton campaign. So yes, that'll hurt him. But Trump has figured out at least one way to avoid some of it, and that's direct communication to the public. I mean, he's out there speaking directly to people. You can hear him. Now, of course, they edit it and so forth, but he's on live. In fact, sometimes they will have an empty podium where they're out there waiting for Donald Trump rather than actually going to an ongoing Hillary speech.
What Trump also has done is gone directly at the news media, treated them as an adversary, treated them without the deference that they expect, and to not too many people's surprise, the public seems to like that.
Yeah, it's a winner.
So it's not enough to probably make up for what you're talking about, but it's Michael, something.
But we had a guest a few minutes ago who was complaining about the media, that the media doesn't show the scrutiny of the terrorist threat that the media would have showed 20 or 30 years ago, and bemoaning the lack of credibility and inquisitiveness. Okay, here we have a presidential candidate who, for all practical purposes, is amazingly ignorant. It doesn't have high school students' knowledge of civics and of current events. We have a candidate who engages in racism and bigotry. And so with all due respect, for the media to be scrutinizing this guy is exactly what they should be doing. They should be exposing him. This is a bad guy.
Yeah. We have to pause. When we come back, we'll hear the Republican side reaction to that. I'm Bruce Dumont from Coast to Coast and Border to Border and around the world on BeyondTheBeltway.com. Thanks for joining us tonight.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
Thank you all very much, Admiral Kelly, Captain Card, officers and sailors of the USS Abraham Lincoln, my fellow Americans. Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night on Antenna TV.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. We briefly talked about the debates and charged that the Fox early debates were somehow tipping the scales in favor of the Republicans. Does everybody remember the first big Fox Republican debate? When the very first question, I think it was from Brett Baer, was about, will everybody take a pledge to support the nominee of the Republican Party? Now, the question was asked because at that particular time, Donald Trump was flirting with the idea of running as a third-party candidate. So it was meant to sort of lock Donald Trump in.
Right.
You remember all the hands that went up?
Yeah.
All the hands that went up and took a pledge that they were going to support the nominee of the Republican Party. Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, John Kasich, Ted Cruz, they all took the pledge. None of them have endorsed Donald Trump yet. Now, why isn't the media calling them on the carpet for standing before the American people and not living up to their pledge?
Well, we all know why they did it.
But there's and videotape of that.
I think that the key, Bruce, is that we didn't have of pictures of their other hand, which was behind their back
with their fingers crossed.
And I think that's what they meant. The other thing I must say is that the Democrats have, in a sense, the same problem with Bernie. He wasn't a Democrat, so they can't even make the claim, let's bring the party together, it's up to you to do it. Now, he's already now said that he won't endorse Hillary. So I just think this is fraud on all.
Let me say something about Bernie Sanders, all right? You know, the interesting question that no one discusses is Bernie Sanders and what he hopes to accomplish, is he better off with Hillary Clinton winning or with Hillary Clinton losing?
Losing.
Of course. Mm-hmm. I mean, he talks about, yes, I'm committed to seeing Donald Trump lose, but all his actions seem to say something different. And my theory is he would be much better off and in really creating his movement and sustaining it in the first term of a Donald Trump presidency.
Absolutely. And to me, it is so obvious that there's been no analysis of that on the national press, at least that I have seen,
right.
Because it's so obvious. And because part of what he's talked about is reforming the Democratic Party, a process that he did not believe was treating him fairly.
Right.
Not only Debbie Wasserman Schultz, but again, the policies that she was enforcing,
right.
The fact that the superdelegates were ramming Hillary Clinton down everybody's throat. An endorsement that came even before he had announced.
Right.
So his problem is with the Democratic Party. You're not going to reform a party that wins the presidency. You only reform
exactly.
The party that loses.
Correct.
And the leader of that party will be Elizabeth Warren if they lose. Chuck Schumer will head them in the Senate. And the fight may be between Chuck and Elizabeth. But Elizabeth likes going out on the stage. She's older, unfortunately, for her. It may be too old to run again. But I think she takes over from Bernie.
From a party standpoint, in 1964, the goal there was to win control of the Republican Party, and they got it. That's
right.
What they wanted. That's what Kitty Kurth, who was here last week,
right.
She was backing away from the issue of superdelegates because you look at 1976. Gerald Ford won that primary or won the convention, won the delegates in Kansas City. The heart of that hall was for Ronald Reagan.
Right.
And Ronald Reagan didn't go out and exactly break a sweat trying to get right. Gerald Ford reelected because there would not have been a Ronald Reagan in 1980
right.
Had Gerald Ford
and
run
the
You and I know why there are superdelegates, right?
Yes.
And the name is McGovern. Yeah.
You got it.
The historical lesson from 1964 is an interesting one, though, because here you have a guy who probably is going to lose. I think that's how people perceive Donald Trump. But the people who shied away from him, Rockefeller, Romney, Sr.,
yep.
Their careers were over. The guys who said, we're going to take a bullet for the party, we're going to campaign, we're going to be loyalists, Nixon and Reagan, who went on to win four elections, two 49-state landslides.
That's, right.
That's the way to play this.
We should remember, for those young people listening to the program, I mean, the anti-establishment wing of the party, it was called the Eastern Establishment at that point, the movement against Barry Goldwater, it was as strong, if not stronger, than what's going on with Donald Trump right now. There are people, they're clinging to their power, and they would rather see the Republican Party go down to ignominious defeat with Donald Trump, because if Donald Trump wins, their careers are long gone.
Right.
If Donald Trump loses, the leadership of the party will be Tom Cotton and Ben Sasse. The young rising outsiders in the Senate. It cannot
right.
go back
no.
to Jeb Bush type
right.
people.
And
the fight in the Republican Party is between the Wall Street and K Street side and the Main Street side, just like the fight in the Democratic Party is between the big unions, the big law firms, all of those people, and the ordinary Democratic voters.
But the other thing that's happening right now, and that is Ted Cruz certainly represented this wing of, and that is the religious right. When have we had a Republican presidential campaign that doesn't seem to be much about the religious right?
What we know about
in this particular, some of them are for Donald Trump, but you know their standard bearer, who was Ted Cruz, he's going nowhere. You wanted to make a comment, Brian?
Well, I had a couple things, but the religious right, isn't that kind of one of the reasons why both Obama and Hillary waited to talk about gay marriage? They both hesitated on that.
Yes.
I think part of that was them trying to tap into that. I do believe that they did support it, but they wouldn't do it politically, which is kind of disgusting. But you mentioned earlier about the Republicans at that debate, and it's obligatory for me to bring up his name here as the resident libertarian. But in 2012, there was a similar question at one of the debates. Romney, Gingrich, all of them were up
yep.
there, and the question was, if there was anyone else on this stage, who would you support? Who did they all say? Ron Paul. Why? because nobody saw him as a credible threat.
Right.
Yeah. So he's
and
easy
why
to
did
throw
he disappear?
Behind.
He disappeared entirely because of the national security question. Unless libertarians have a strong answer right. to what they're right. going to do to the questions that Bob Pape just talked about when he talked about terrorism, libertarian candidates are really going to be able to go no place because national security issues are darned important.
Answer the question. What is the answer? What is the libertarian position on national security and fighting terrorism?
It's not aggression and it's not interventionism. The interventionism is what gets us in trouble in a lot of these places. We're being attacked right now with our own weapons. It used to be long ago that we would go and give weapons to a group out in the Middle East, and then it would take 10 to 20 years later before
true.
They came back
what
to
What would
us.
You do in the South China Sea?
That's more trade, and that involves a lot more nations. That's not going and intervening
no,
in
no.
war.
No, the Chinese Navy is moving out to interdict what is an international waterway.
Yes.
What would you do about Russia?
It's not the same thing as going into another country. Those are international
Let's
waters.
Let's assume we're not going to be doing any more big interventions like that. We've learned our lesson. Let's make that mm-hmm. assumption. What about the other big issues about American involvement overseas?
Well, for example, we've got a lot of obligations that we have through NATO. Right now, we're in a way where if Russia and Turkey, the way they've been going at each other just these last few months, we would be obligated to defend Turkey in a war with Russia. Who wants to do that in NATO, where you got 60-some-odd nations that are together? They're not even meeting their own spending obligations.
So you would unwind NATO?
I would not want to make the same commitment when other nations aren't keeping on their half of it. We'd rather defend ourselves and focus on ourselves here at home.
Well, the lesson from World Wars I and II was that when Europe is in chaos and is melting down, we're in for the landing, so we might as well be in to help guide the takeoff. And I think that the answer that you gave is part of the problem that libertarians have as long as they're not just a kind of aspirational vote but are actually in a serious conversation.
How does Gary Johnson's position differ, in your view, Michael, from what Donald Trump's position is? Because he's somewhat isolation yeah. or America first, as the way he's described
Trump
it.
Is what Walter Russell Mead calls a Jacksonian, okay? He believes in having a very strong military that you use sparingly and
Jack
cautiously.
Something.
Well, as to NATO, he said we should have a NATO summit and we should reconfigure what this alliance is for. If you talk to people who actually deal day to day with NATO militaries, they're underfunded, they are bureaucratically incompetent, and
he just wants to send them a larger invoice. That's the way I read.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think he's a little more serious than that. He says, "What is this alliance actually doing for us today? Look, it's a 70-year-old alliance. It helped us win the Cold War. It was a very effective government program. Right now, it's inert and it needs
so
to
I'll
be reconceptualized."
You know how you always talk about rumors and innuendos,
Absolutely.
Bruce? I want to give you a rumor and innuendo.
Okay.
The Russians really, really, really don't want Hillary Clinton to be the president. They would much prefer Trump. Trump has said not only nice things about Putin, he's talked about rejiggering NATO and other things that the Russians like. They look at Hillary Clinton and they see Bill Clinton's expansion of NATO into Central Europe and they do not like it. So here's a rumor and innuendo. If they have hacked into Hillary Clinton's server, they have all of her emails, and they can release those whenever they choose to do so at the most damaging time.
And will they do it?
Of course they'll do it if they have them, and they'll do it if she's—
But wouldn't they have them, and wouldn't somebody know they have them? Because Edward Snowden is sitting in Russia.
3 weeks before the election.
They release them.
3 weeks before the election is when
they
release them.
What would be the impact of that, Michael? Because that could fly the other way. If the Russians are leaking this bad information about Hillary,
they'll do it without their fingerprints.
They'll do it covertly.
They'll do it covertly.
And the question becomes, what's in the substance of the emails? But I think we're talking about what's going to happen in the couple months before the election. And various parties overseas, you know, not just the Russians,
right.
but our enemies at ISIS have a stake in the election as well. And certainly they probably want to see a Donald Trump presidency. So the question becomes,
why would they want to see
because a Donald Trump presidency will turn moderate Muslims more hardcore because of the paintbrush he paints all Muslims with.
We will continue. I'm Bruce Dumont from Coast to Coast and Border to Border. Thank you for joining us on this 4th of July weekend. Hopefully you're having a great time this Sunday night. And when you're coming back on the road, be careful. It's one of the busiest times of the year. Back shortly.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels. Join me for a new season of Wild Travels, Sundays at 11 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
The Museum of Broadcast Communications is Chicago's perfect place for senior citizens. Enjoy a stroll down memory lane. Reminisce as museum artifacts, photos, and classic TV shows trigger recollections from your childhood. Enjoy the TLC you'll receive from our expert tour guides. Discounts for groups of 20 or more. Schedule yours right now at museum.tv or call 312-245-8200. Plan your fun trip now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We continue with Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us. Special guest right now, Sidney Blumenthal. Sidney Blumenthal is one of the leading political operatives and advisor to Bill and Hillary Clinton over the years, and a native Chicagoan. So welcome back, graduate of Sullivan High School. Nice to have you back in Chicago. And in the early days of this program, was a guest on this show for a number of times. But you're back now talking about a new book that you've published. It's about Abraham Lincoln. It's called The Political Life of Abraham Lincoln, A Self-Made Man. And I guess my first question to you would be, with all of the books that have been written about Abraham Lincoln, what was the slice of his life that you felt needed exploration? Because this is the first of several books you're writing on the subject.
Yes. This is the first of four volumes. I've written four volumes. They're going to be published one a year. This one deals with Lincoln's early life up to the age of 40, when he rises from extreme poverty to become a skilled political man who has served one term in Congress and acquired the political skills in Illinois and in Washington to become the great emancipator. And I use my own background to understand Lincoln, I think, in a new way and provide an original interpretation of Lincoln as a politician. He was of the first generation of Americans who were professional politicians. That's how he made himself. And Lincoln was uniquely self-made. I have been a journalist for decades. I was a correspondent in Washington who covered presidents. I served in the White House with the president. I've been in campaigns and elections. And I think I have gone through the research in a way and have an angle of vision that's different from a lot of other people. Mm-hmm. And I think I understand the motivations of people who are political. And Abraham Lincoln, who we think of as sitting in that great monument above us, yeah, was actually a living, breathing politician to the marrow of his bones.
And he loved it. I mean, because the popular perception is that he was so noble, he wouldn't dabble in politics. But he would roll up the sleeve. He would dabble big time.
Well, his law partner, William Herndon, he had a two-man law office, said politics was his heaven. And Lincoln learned it from the beginning in Illinois. He, from the age of 23 on, he ran constantly for office. He was the leader of the Whig Party. There was a major party called the Whig Party. He spent most of his life in that party. He was called the Sangamon Chieftain. He was head of the Springfield Junto. He was the power against his great rival for decades, Stephen A. Douglas, leader of the Democratic Party in the state of Illinois.
Tell us about his first inclination about slavery. How did his concern for slavery, how did that evolve?
Lincoln said he was naturally anti-slavery. He was actually born to it. His father, who was a poor dirt farmer, semi-literate, fled Kentucky across the Ohio River into Indiana to get away from slavery. He was a white man. Why? Because he had to compete for wages against slaves. And so the Lincoln family began its life, really, fleeing slavery. Lincoln grew up in his family in these small, tiny, emancipationist churches, as they were called, in rural Kentucky, and they were anti-slavery. And so Lincoln had this in his DNA in the beginning, and it developed. He went down the Mississippi as a boy like Huck Finn to New Orleans, and he was shocked at what he saw, open-air emporium of slaves sold on street corners. And his view of slavery was highly unusual at the time. He was never an abolitionist, but he was anti-slavery. The abolitionists were like the radicals of the day. Mm-hmm. He was more of a main... He wanted to get ahead as
Were they
a main,
more the elites?
Well, they were more from New England and religiously right. oriented.
Right.
They were more... a lot of the abolitionists were ministers, and the Illinois Anti-Slavery Society, which was the basis of abolitionism in Illinois, was created by an association of Protestant ministers. So that was the basis of that movement. It was considered to be immoral, slavery.
You said that he ran... How many times did he run and lose before he won his first seat?
He ran and lost his first race for the state legislature, and then he won. He was this raw kid running for office, and he was known as the slasher because of his sarcastic, cutting style. He developed, you know, the Lincoln that we think of, you know, malice towards none, charity for all. That took decades to develop into that character. He started as somebody who would stand on platforms in Illinois and cut his opponents apart. And that's how he gained his credibility
within
the Whig Party.
A little bit like Donald Trump.
Well, not like Donald Trump. He was.
But did he eviscerate them on political grounds or on personal grounds?
He eviscerated them on political grounds, mm-hmm. and he fought very hard for his issues. And his issues in Illinois were what was called internal improvement, or what we would call infrastructure. And he became the Whig floor leader when he was 27 years old on the Illinois legislature.
What was his claim to fame? I mean, when he was working in the Illinois legislature, what were the things that he was a big winner on? You mentioned that he worked on what, but was did he have statewide notoriety?
Well, he was well known in Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
He was he created a lot of the infrastructure of what was then the modern economy of Illinois. The mm-hmm. Michigan-Illinois Canal is right. due to Lincoln. Lincoln's responsible for creating that. The movement of the capital to Springfield from Vandalia, which was a rough-and-tumble frontier town, and then the building of the state capital and the creation of Springfield, that was Lincoln's doing. He did that. And there was a lot of trading and lobbying that went on to be able to move that capital. So Lincoln was a real player in Illinois.
But as you said a few moments ago, a political obsession with Stephen A. Douglas.
Totally.
Personally as well as politically?
Lincoln and Douglas knew each other well. Douglas had courted Mary Todd before Lincoln married her. Douglas was also a self-made man. He was a Vermonter, turned himself into what he called a Westerner. He was the leader of the Democratic Party. Douglas was the real demagogue. Lincoln feared his use of illogic and non sequiturs and vicious personal attacks, and Douglas also used racial attacks against Lincoln and anybody else who stood in his way. Douglas rose higher and faster than Lincoln. Lincoln always was trailing after Douglas. But the thing is that Douglas, who became a real star of the Democratic Party, was from Illinois. And eventually, the only person in the whole country who could challenge Stephen A. Douglas on his home ground was Abraham Lincoln. Mm-hmm. And as a result of Douglas being here, Lincoln rose.
Right.
Without Douglas, there's no Lincoln.
Right. So he had to have his foil. And he happened to be... They were fighting for the control of the state of Illinois, and then it grew beyond that, obviously.
Illinois became the platform that the whole country looked at, especially in that Senate race in 1858, where they staged their famous debates.
In the presidential run, and your book is, again, about the first years of his life. It isn't necessarily all the presidential things, which, again, the subsequent volumes will deal with. But what was his early association with the Chicago Tribune, which historically was very responsible for his push to the presidency? But how early was there a liaison between this country lawyer from downstate and the Chicago Tribune?
Chicago Tribune was a very important part of Lincoln's rise and part of his organization. And the editors of the Tribune, like Charles Ray, the first editors, were operatives who worked very closely with Lincoln. At first, they distrusted him because they thought of themselves more on the abolitionist side. Lincoln, however, gained their trust. They realized that he was the master politician they needed to make their movement work. And it was through that combination, that coalition, that Lincoln was able to create the Illinois Republican Party. The Chicago Tribune was absolutely indispensable to him, not only in creating the Republican Party in the state of Illinois, but also in winning the nomination of the Republican Party, which took place at a convention in Chicago in which the Tribune and their editors played a key role in rolling that convention for Lincoln.
If there were 24-hour cable news then, would Lincoln and the Tribune been able to get away with what they got away with if everybody was watching every move they did?
Well, here's my view. My view is that Lincoln played by the rules of the game of his day, and he vindicated his principles ultimately. And he knew that it took 1,000 small political acts to achieve anything. He was a very skilled and experienced political actor. Would they have gotten away? Well, Lincoln was accused of all kinds of things. There were all kinds of so-called scandals, and Lincoln was involved in the back and forth. For example, you know, we talk about a joke about Lincoln's doctor. Well, Lincoln's doctor, a man named Anson Henry, was put in charge of building all the public buildings in Springfield after Lincoln moved the Capitol, and the Democrats accused him of corruption and skimming money. And Lincoln, of course, had to defend him and got in the middle of this imbroglio. So, you know, what happens now is not so novel. This has been going on for quite a while.
But was the media of the day aggressive in calling attention to that? Again, if he had the protection of the Chicago Tribune, were there others that were letting the public know about sort of the different side of Abraham Lincoln or a different side of Abraham
Lincoln? Well, all the newspapers of the day, without exception, were partisan newspapers. They were all party newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
Lincoln had his newspapers. He was the virtual co-editor of the paper in Springfield, and he anonymously wrote editorials. But guess who was the owner of the Democratic newspaper, The Register? That would have been Stephen A. Douglas.
Okay.
And Douglas didn't miss
a beat. So they all have their clout.
They all have their clout, and Douglas and the Democratic papers didn't miss a beat in attacking Lincoln and the Whigs and then the Republicans.
We're talking with Sidney Blumenthal. The title of the book is The Political Life of Abraham Lincoln, A Self-Made Man. Tonight on Beyond the Beltway, back shortly from Chicago. Come on down to the Museum of Broadcast Communications and enjoy Watching TV in the 1990s, a new exhibition featuring pop culture memorabilia, trend-setting TV shows, music videos, and commercials. Remember Beanie Babies, Touchtone Phones, and the Macarena? Turn back the clock 20 years and bring your friends. Now showing at the NBC 360 North State Street in Chicago. That's 360 North State Street in downtown Chicago.
The beauty of Amling's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlings now at 888-880-TREE. We continue with Sidney Blumenthal, author of the book, The Political Life of Abraham Lincoln. We're talking about the early years of Abraham Lincoln. How early in Lincoln's life did he meet Mary Todd? And it's been said that there would not have been an Abraham Lincoln without Mary Todd. Tell us a little bit about her and how that relationship began.
Mary Todd is a Southern belle. She arrives in Springfield to seek a husband. She's brought by her sister. Her sister is married to a man named Ninian W. Edwards, who is the son of the territorial governor. They're the most prominent social family in Springfield. They live on Aristocracy Hill. Lincoln is, as he calls himself later, a poor nobody. And he's entranced with this woman, this younger woman who speaks French, has gone to a finishing school. Lincoln's had only a few weeks of formal education. And he breaks up with her. He even has a nervous breakdown. Imagine what the media would have done with that.
Mm-hmm.
And after about a year, they're reconciled and they get back together. Here's the thing about Mary Todd.
Is the nervous breakdown tied to the breakup of the relationship?
It is. Lincoln couldn't figure out how to approach the opposite sex, and it's also tied to his political crisis he had where he was publicly embarrassed. So it all happened at once. Lincoln didn't have a family at that point. He had separated himself from his poor family that had gone off to Colt County, Illinois, and he was basically on his own. He felt publicly humiliated. He had a deep sense of social inferiority that he tried to hide because of his background of neglect and poverty and ignorance that he grew up in. And that he had risen above.
He was an
above.
Abused child? I mean,
he was an abused child. Right. His father would punish him for reading. He considered reading a form of laziness. Lincoln was determined to read, and he was curious about the world, and he learned about politics. He attached himself to local lawyers who had libraries. That's how he read the Constitution, law books, learned about the Declaration of Independence, history of the country. But back to Mary Todd. She's a political woman. Her father is the business partner and political ally in Lexington, Kentucky, of Henry Clay. She grew up knowing Clay. She was described as a child as a violent little Whig. And Clay
was Lincoln's hero.
Clay is Lincoln's idol. He calls him his beau ideal. He's one of the most prominent political figures of the day. He's the creator of the Whig Party that Lincoln is part of. And to be associated with Henry Clay through this woman is quite an achievement on Lincoln's part. Here's the thing about her, as I'm saying. She voices her political opinions in public discussions. And women are not supposed to talk about politics, but she doesn't care. And she has very strong opinions. And she, after they get married, Lincoln, of course, was fiercely ambitious. His law partner said his ambition was a little engine that knew no rest. But sometimes he would underestimate himself, and that had to do with his sense of social inferiority. But his wife would not allow him to do that. So one time when he was reelected to the state legislature, she said, "That's not good enough. You have to run for the Senate." She would always push him forward. She thought he was greater than even he thought he was.
Were they madly in love, or in your interpretation, did he see her as sort of a meal ticket to a better life?
I think that he was in love with her, and he remained smitten with her. And she was completely devoted to him and thought he was a spectacular person. And she thought he had immense potential. She revolted against her family, her upper-class family, to marry him. They called him a plebeian. And they announced their wedding to her family in one day, and they had to patch together a quick wedding within 24 hours. But this was a love match, but also a match of people of like political minds who also love politics, and it was a socially mobile move on Lincoln's part. He now was a member of the most prominent family in Springfield.
What political influence did she have on him? Obviously, she gave him the credibility, and obviously it led him to the White House, but how much of a political influence was she on him when he moved into the presidency?
She was a great asset to him. What we know about her and think about her from some historians is that she was a liability because she threw temper tantrums, she was volatile, she created embarrassing scenes, but Mary Todd was a political woman, and she knew how to lobby political people. And she knew, for example, that the very difficult Senator Charles Sumner of Massachusetts was somebody who needed special care and tending. And she would invite him over and have educated conversations with him. He was quite a scholar. They would invite him to the inauguration. Lincoln pulled a great coup. Sumner was sulking against Lincoln and playing with his program, and Lincoln pulled his carriage up in front of Sumner's house on the evening of the second inaugural, and he goes out and he pulls Sumner into the carriage and says, "I'd really like you to escort the First Lady into the inaugural ball." And Sumner is beaming. He's happy. So, and Mary Todd knows what they're doing, and she's part of this game. She's a real political player.
A little bit like House of Cards characters. You mentioned earlier that this is the first of four books that you've written, and you say they've already been written?
I've written, this book has just been published. The second book I've submitted to my publisher, Simon & Schuster, redrafting the third one. The fourth one, which covers Lincoln's great triumph in the war, his assassination, and then what happens to his legacy in Reconstruction, has been written. So one a year. I'm eager to talk about Abraham Lincoln.
You're going to be talking about Abraham Lincoln for a long time.
Well, there are worse things to do, and let me just say, I really enjoy his company.
Sidney Blumenthal, thanks very much for being with us tonight. We really appreciate it. The title of the book is The Political Life of Abraham Lincoln, A Self-Made Man. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Our thanks to Colin Bobbitt and Fritz Goldman and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week, good night from Chicago.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida, so why not experience it as it was meant to be, where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
The Signal, a rockin' new hit musical. From doo-wop to the king of pop, blues, to the Beatles, gospel, to great radio hits. The Signal, the musical about a steel town and its street corner sounds. Starring live, the Spaniels, Hall of Famer Willie Rogers of the Soul Stirrers, and Stormy Weather. August 12th, 13th, and 14th. Tickets on sale now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications box office or TicketWeb.com.
Are you headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a Four Diamond Hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, CityWalk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton, Los Angeles, Universal City. At HiltonUniversal.com, they let you be the star in Hollywood.
The beauty of Amlinks Interior Landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlinks now at 888-880-TREE.